Lecture 19, Thutmose III, King at Last.
Welcome back again. Remember last time we talked about obelisks? Well, I'd like to go back to our chronological tour of Egypt and go back to Hatshepsut, who was two lectures ago, and just review a little bit. Because today we're going to talk about Thutmose III, her nephew's stepson, and we've got to remember some important facts about Hatshepsut. You'll remember that she was the daughter of a king, she was the wife of a king, and then ruled in place of her stepson for about 22 years she was ruling. But the curious thing about Hatshepsut, the unique thing, is that she didn't rule as queen. After a few years, she changed her titles and called herself king. So she was King Hatshepsut. She wore the false beard of a pharaoh, wore the kilt of a pharaoh, right? But she wasn't claiming she was a man. She was clearly a woman, but she was king of Egypt. Now, you'll also remember that we talked about how do you become king. And you became king by marrying the right woman. Not in terms of romance, but the right woman in terms of having royal blood in her veins. Well, Thutmose III becomes the next king. He's her nephew, and even her stepson also. But how did he become king? Well, remember Hatshepsut had a daughter. Many, many Egyptologists believe that the way Thutmose III became king, complete king, full king, justified king, was he was married to Hatshepsut's daughter. Now, the daughter dies at an early age, leaving Thutmose III as a young kid, a widower. But many people believe he must have been married to the daughter so he could really assume kingship. It could be. We don't have any records of such a marriage, though. But we certainly know for sure he is considered king at a very early age. His aunt, Hatshepsut, rules in his place. She is the regent. And then she declares herself king also. And we don't hear a word about Thutmose III for years. Right? We don't even know where he was. Now, one of the theories, as we heard, was that Hatshepsut kind of pushes him aside, you know, practically keeps him in jail, just keeps him out of the way so she can rule. Finally, when she dies, he comes out. But I think a more plausible theory, when we look at his behavior today, when we look at Thutmose III's behavior, a more plausible theory is that he's off training with the military. You know, he's a teenager growing up. He's doing, you know, playing with boys' toys. He is going with the army, training to be a military man. Because when he becomes pharaoh by himself, he is going to be the greatest military pharaoh Egypt has ever seen. And they've had some good ones. Now, let me say something about warfare in ancient Egypt. It was big business. It wasn't intended as defense. No. Egyptians did not want peace. Peace was not a virtue. What you were supposed to do as a pharaoh was take your army, march out, conquer foreign territories, take everything that wasn't nailed down, and bring it back. And that's the purpose of an army. Now, in the New Kingdom, where we are now, especially in the 18th dynasty, a standing army becomes big business. Big business. And let me describe a little bit of this big business to you. First, of course, we know the reason Egypt could afford a standing army is the Nile's abundance. They could grow more food than they needed and feed an army. They could also feed the priesthood, and that's why you get loads of priests in Egypt. But the army could be fed. Now, what kind of equipment do you need for an army? Well, there was always this sort of arms race. Everybody wants the big thing, the big stick. And in Egypt, they picked it up from the Hyksos. It was the chariot, the horse-drawn chariot. Now, chariots were the elite. Like the chariot corps was the elite of the army. Chariots were interesting machines. They were very light, very light. You wanted it to be maneuverable in battle. They were drawn by two horses, a pair. And you know, the Egyptians, we have drawings of chariots, lots of them on temple walls. Usually today, everybody has matched pairs. When you have a team of horses, you know, the colors are right. They're either both black, both white, both gray. Egyptians never cared about that. They, in a sense, they weren't horse people right from the beginning. They didn't care about things like that because they picked it up from the Hyksos. The Hyksos are the ones who bring in the first horse. So the chariot is pulled by two horses, and it's really light so you can maneuver in battle. Chariots were made of three different kinds of wood. You needed one kind of wood. They had ash, poplar, right? You needed one kind of wood for the wheels so you could bend. You needed one kind of wood that would bend easily so you could have wheels. You needed another kind for axles, which would be strong but a little bit of flexibility, right? So these were really kind of craftsmanship-like pieces. These are not just cranked-out factory stuff. You needed guys who could really work wood, good carpenters. Now, the chariot was used basically as a platform on which an archer could shoot his arrows. That was the function of it. So you've got two people on a chariot. You've got the driver holding the reins of his team of horses, and you've got your archer, who is standing on the platform also, with his, you know, quiver. He's got his arrows going, and you're trying to shoot arrows from this moving thing with two horses pulling you around not so smooth ground. Now, what do you use as shock absorbers? Well, you don't really have real shock absorbers. What you've got is the platform you're standing on is made out of woven leather, strips of leather across, right? And as your charioteer is, you know, controlling it, trying to give you a good shooting position, you're kind of bouncing a little bit, but it's absorbing some of the shock. You're not just going boom, 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 boom. You're kind of going nice and smoothly, a little bit evening it out. So the chariot was really your big weapon in military warfare, and they were expensive. One of the things we hear about all the time, is they broke. You had to take, you know, if you were going with an army, you had lots of carpenters. These are guys that are going to fix wheels on the road, and they took with them spares, right? So these were not low-maintenance vehicles, but they were important. And the charioteers were the elite, but they weren't the largest body of the army. That was the infantry. If you want to know how fast you could move an army, you look at your infantry. What can the infantry do? And the answer is about 15 miles a day. These guys are going to walk. So figure it roughly, just roughly, that every 100 miles an army is going to go, it's a 7-day week. That's how long. You know, so if you're going 600 miles, 6 weeks, roughly. So the infantry is going to be your pacemaker. Every infantryman, everyone, had a round-topped shield. Now, if you look on Egyptian temple walls where there are scenes of battles, there are certain ways of telling the good guys from the bad guys. The Egyptians are the ones who have the round-topped shields. Other guys have different-shaped shields, but our guys have the round-topped shields. Right? Good to know. Also, by the way, when they camped, when they finally settled for the night, they would take these round-topped shields and they'd stick them in the ground, forming like a picket fence all around their encampment. And you see this on temple walls also. So every infantryman has his round-top shield, which is basically a piece of wood with an animal hide over it. Right? So nothing's going to come through that easily. It's going to protect you from arrows, hopefully, if you see it coming. But more important, the infantry are going to be hand-to-hand battle. Now, what do you use for the battle? Well, infantrymen usually had either a spear or a sword, sometimes both. So they're marching with their shield, spear, or sword, or both. That's your infantry. These guys were the lower class members of the army. They weren't really skilled. They were usually illiterate. We think that maybe at most 20% of the Egyptian population was literate, and that's probably a high estimate, really high. But certainly your infantry guys, no, they weren't literate. Then you had one other fairly elite corps, the archers. Because these were guys who really had to practice a lot. And the archers were considered special, right? And they marched with the infantry. So we've got an army made up basically of chariots, infantry, archery. Right? That's medieval warfare. And always remember, the king is not the great general who's standing back and calling the shots. He is right up at the front in a chariot, leading the charge with his men. That's what he's expected to do. That was warfare in the ancient world. When you killed somebody, you usually killed them face to face. None of these distance weapons. You know, the archers maybe didn't see the guy. No, they usually did. They would see him. But this was real hand-to-hand, brutal stuff. Right? Now, our man Thutmose III, greatest military pharaoh of all time. He must have been training with the military while Hatshepsut ruled. Must have. As soon as he takes over on his own, and there are two ways you can date his reign, by the way. When his father dies, because he's sort of king, or when he takes over on his own after Hatshepsut dies. So remember, Hatshepsut is sort of calling the shots. For 22 years, Thutmose is waiting. And now, in the second year of his reign, by himself, right, year two, he marches out with the army. And he's going to a place called Megiddo. It's in an area that we call Syro-Palestine, Syria and Palestine, in the north. Now, why is he going there? The answer is, I mean, believe me, Megiddo didn't do anything to Egypt. They weren't bothering anybody. The reason he's going there is that although Hatshepsut, Aunt Hatshepsut, said that she was the female pharaoh, which she was, she really didn't lead great military charges. We have a few inscriptions that says she went to Nubia. We have a carving on her temple wall that shows her as a sphinx with a beard trampling on the enemy. But she really didn't lead the army. So during her 22 years or so, the army must have been kind of going into disrepair. They're not marching out. They're not beating up people. And Syria and Palestine were growing independent. See, just before Hatshepsut, they was having to send tribute to Egypt, sort of protection money. You know, don't come up and smash us. Here's some goodies. But now they're growing independent, and Thutmose III is going to change that. He's going to fix all that. So year two, he marches out to Megiddo, right? Infantry, chariots, right? Archers, the whole thing. The army was probably a little rusty, by the way. You know, they hadn't had a real big battle, as far as we know. So they were maybe a little rusty. But anyway, the big thing about Megiddo, year two, that's where Thutmose establishes himself as brave, fearless. They're marching. And they're about to get to Megiddo. And they're at a place where there are three possible routes to take. Two of the routes are rather wide open, kind of like plains. The other route, the third, is a valley. It's narrow. Now, common sense says, military sense says, you don't go through the valley because your army is going to be strung out one after the other. And the tail end isn't going to be able to fight if you encounter anybody as you're marching through the valley. So the logic is take one of the two open routes. Thutmose says, we're going by the valley. Now his generals talk to him. And they say, Majesty, if we go, and as the phrase is, man behind man, horse behind horse, meaning single file. If we go single file, we could get annihilated. Now, Thutmose says, are you afraid? He says, I'm the falcon. I'm the pharaoh. I won't put you in danger, but I will go. If any of my men want to follow, follow me. Now, how do we know he said this? Well, we've got accounts on temple walls by military scribes, whose job it was to sort of write what happens. We don't know how accurate it is, but we do have accounts of this battle. And the men say, no, we will follow our pharaoh. So there's little doubt that they really did take this dumb route, the valley route. What happens? Well, the army at Megiddo figured they were going to take one of the other two routes, and Thutmose's army surprises them, totally takes them off guard, and wipes them out. Right? So great, great, great bout. So they surprise them. They're killing people left and right. And then what happens? And the scribe, the military scribe, records it. And it's not a real plus. So I think this really happened. It's not the kind of thing you might brag about. They've routed the other army. What does our Egyptian army do? They start plundering the bodies on the battlefield. They're going for their swords. You know, bronze was a good thing. They're going for their shields. They're going for anything they can get that's not nailed down. This is their loot. This is their booty. But they let the army get away. And the army retreats to Megiddo. So now we've got an Egyptian army that has some stuff. You know, they've got shields under their arm. I can imagine these guys with swords, whatever they can take. But the basic force of the other army has gotten away into Megiddo. Now, Megiddo, like every other major ancient city, is a walled city. Big walls, fortress. and they certainly shut the doors. And our military scribe records, because the men plundered, we had to siege this city for 7 months. That's an unfortunate truth, but that's what happened. So for 7 months, Thutmose's army is trying to siege this city. Difficult. You've got thick walls. Now, you've got thick walls, and you're going to go through with battering rams, probably. Because, you know, cities were getting pretty smart by this time. This is 18th dynasty. We've had a lot of wars. They knew to have their own water supply. They would dig tunnels down under the wells. They would have food inside. It's going to take a while. And when you try to go through a wall, you've got guys on top who are throwing down boulders. You've got archers shooting down. It is not an easy thing to siege any city. But after 7 months, they finally get in. By the way, the Egyptians even invented the equivalent of a tank for sieging cities. What it is, it's a little kind of little, look at it as a little hut on wheels. And in the hut are three Egyptians with battering rams. And the hut is covered so that when guys throw rocks down, it won't hit the Egyptians. So they wheel this thing against the wall, and we've got pictures of guys pushing the battering ram against the mud brick wall, trying to get it down, right? So after 7 months, Megiddo is taken. Thutmose returns the hero, and it's put on temple wall. His reputation is established, but he doesn't rest on that reputation. He keeps on going. For the next 18 years, he marches north to Syria every year. Right? Now, why does he have to go marching north to Syria every year? I think the answer lies in the Egyptian religion. Remember, they were resurrectionists? They believed that the body was literally going to go up and, you know, get up and go again in the next world. And that's why you had to mummify it and preserve it. And remember the myth of Isis and Osiris, that you had to be buried on Egyptian soil? Well, nobody wanted to live outside of Egypt. Because if you died outside of Egypt, you lose your chance for immortality. If you don't have embalmers there, if you can't be brought back. And remember, it's a long haul back to Egypt from Syria. So the Egyptians never had colonies. They never had a large standing army staying in a foreign country. You never had the Egyptians colonizing anywhere. They thought Egypt was the best place on earth. So, when you conquer a country like Syria, you take everything you see, you bring back cattle, you bring back some people as slaves, and then you're back in Egypt. You know, a month's march away. And you tell the Syrians every year, send tribute. I want this amount of gold, this amount of this. But you've been gone for a year. And they forget things. And there's no reason to send the gold if you're not there. So you march out again, you beat them up, you take the gold, and you go back. And this happens every year for 18 years. So because the Egyptians never colonized, because they never had a large body of people that was willing to live in a foreign country, they were in a constant state of war because they always want the goodies that you got from another country. Right? So it's really the religion that caused this constant state of war. So Thutmose III was constantly at war, constantly, and he seemed to love it. There is no indication that there was any other interest of his besides this militaristic thing. You know, it's quite interesting to look at his statues, by the way. They're not at all the picture of a crude guy. He looks actually rather refined. And you can tell a Thutmose statue in one way. He's got a nose that's a little bit too big. It's not an idealized portrait. It's a beautiful portrait, but it's a little bit of a big nose. You can tell that from his statues. And you know what? He's got the same nose as Hatshepsut, his aunt. Well, they were related. It makes sense. But you can usually tell a Thutmose statue. Anyway, when Thutmose returned from Syria, he usually carved the results of his expeditions on his temple walls at Karnak in Thebes, one of the major temples of the world. One of the things that impressed him were plants. Now, I don't mean to say he was a botanist, but when he came back, he did something that nobody else ever did. He carved on the walls of Karnak Temple a kind of botanical book. He showed all the plants that they had seen in Syria that nobody had ever seen before. Because, you know, think about what it must have been like to go to Syria. They were marching through fields of wildflowers. They never saw anything like that in Egypt. Or even, you know, if they got sort of to the north of Syria, you can see snow on the mountains of Lebanon. This is the kind of adventure, you know, guys came back from and talked about forever. And then Tutmosis comes back and he carves flowers on the walls of his temple. And I'll tell you something, you know, I'm from New York, from the city. I know nothing about plants. But when I talk to the botanists, you know, and they look at these things and I say, what does this look like? Almost all of them say, they're not very good drawings. They're not very good carvings. They say, they're trying to remember what they saw, but this plant couldn't flower, this plant isn't this. So they're not very good, but they were at least trying to say, look, we saw some interesting stuff. And it shows, I think, that Tutmosis had an inquisitive mind. He wasn't just sort of just military, but that's what he loved to do. He builds a couple of small temples at Karnak. Nothing spectacular, not like his aunt's at Deir el-Bahari, nothing like that. But the one thing that happens late in his reign that I sort of regret is that late in his reign, he decides to erase his aunt's name, Hatshepsut's name, from all the records. Late in his reign, not because of malice, but rather Egypt had the sense that we shouldn't record that we had a female who was our king. So Hatshepsut's name is erased from the various temples where it appeared. Now, Tutmosis had many wives. Many wives. He probably, I say probably because there's no marriage record, probably married Hatshepsut's daughter, who dies as a teenager. But at least he was established as king, and now he can marry anyone he wants. And in this century, in the early part of this century, modern tomb robbers in Egypt found the tomb of three of Tutmosis's ladies of the harem, probably women he may have married, they may have been concubines. But what's interesting about all three, and it was found with jewelry. I mean, the women had their jewels with them. Rather elegant diadems, you know, little crowns, very flimsy type crowns. And they were, now I say tomb robbers found this. And the reason I emphasize the tomb robbers rather than excavators is that these objects were sold on the antiquities market. That's how they appeared. We really didn't know much about the details of just how were they found. We would have loved to see them in situ, as we say, just as they were found on the heads of the mummies or whatever. But we don't know. They were sold on the market, and they were bought by the Metropolitan Museum of Art. So they're in the Metropolitan Museum of Art today, and you can see them in New York, and they're rather beautiful. But what's most important is you can tell from the workmanship, from the design, and the names of these princesses. They were Syrians. They were not native Egyptians. Now, I don't mean to say that he didn't have his share of Egyptian wives. He did, because remember, every pharaoh could have a great wife, several other wives, and concubines. But what this shows is that while he's doing battle all the time with the Syrians, 18 years in a row, you know, pounding them, there are also these kind of diplomatic marriages. Usually, when a pharaoh marries a foreigner, it's not this wild, passionate love affair, no. It's a diplomatic thing to sort of seal relations. And he's married to three Syrians, right? But he's still going to go and take the tribute, right? He's still going to do that. But there's a sense that this was established order. It was kind of, it's okay. Now, eventually, like all good men, Tutmosis dies. And his tomb is rather unusual. Now, remember that Grandpa Tutmosis I, right? Tutmosis I had the first tomb in the Valley of the Kings, right? The second tomb in the Valley of the Kings is probably Tutmosis II. The third tomb in the Valley of the Kings is Hatshepsut, because she's ruling as king, wants her own tomb. And now Tutmosis III continues the tradition and builds a tomb in the Valley of the Kings. And it's unusual. I really should say it's unusual. First, its location. Now, I think at this point, you know, like the fourth or so tomb in the Valley of the King, people are clearly aware that the kings are buried in this desolate place on the west bank of the Nile. And Tutmosis must have been worried about robbery. There must have been people coming, going, and he must have been worried. So he does something that none of the previous three do. He has his tomb carved in the valley. It's in the valley. It's as the tourists come in, when you're coming through the tourist entrance, and it's the basic entrance to the valley, It's way in the back of the valley, all the way in the back, but way up in the cliff, way up. It is not dug into the bedrock immediately, not carved into the cliff and then down. It's 100 feet up, at least. I think he's trying to put it in a place that nobody's going to see it or go to. Now, what probably the construction technique for this tomb, I think, and I think most architects would agree, it's the architecture people who really know about this stuff. Steps are cut in the cliff so the workmen can get up there and start carving. And by the way, when you cut a tomb, let me tell you how to make your own tomb in case you ever want to make a tomb. If you cut a tomb, you always start from the top to the bottom, never bottom up, never chiseling from the bottom to the top. The reason is it's much easier on your muscles to swing a hammer, a mallet, downward all the time than if you start on the bottom and go up to the ceiling, you're going to wind up lifting your mallet all the way up to do it. So you always start at the top of a doorway and cut out the doorway, say, from top to bottom. It's kind of like, you know, when you're painting a wall, or if you're painting a ceiling, your arm gets tired fast because it's really extended and hard, but it's a lot easier to paint a floor if you're painting a floor. So this is why you always chisel from the top down. Now, he starts at the top of the cliff, and almost certainly there are steps cut in the cliff so the workmen can get all the way up there, and they start chiseling into the mountain. And they chisel a descending passageway, going way into the mountain. I'm talking hundreds of feet. You go down, down, down. And then there's another flight of stairs, so to speak, and you go down again till you finally hit the burial chamber. Right? The burial chamber. It's special. It's carved in the shape of a cartouche. Right? It is shaped like an oval. Rather beautiful. Rather beautiful. And I think it's the idea of magical encircling. That, remember, the cartouche is the oval that encircled the pharaoh's name. And the idea is that for eternity, Thutmose is encircled. And if that wasn't enough, we have a backup plan. His sarcophagus is in the shape of a cartouche. It's an oval also. So he is doubly protected, encircled. And around the sarcophagus are goddesses protecting him. So this is a very, very special tomb. He's a man who, you know, wasn't sort of hindered without a vision. He's willing to put plants on his temple. He has a burial chamber in the shape of a cartouche. Now, he may not have thought of this. This may not have been his idea. It's certainly possible that his architect suggests it. But he's open to it, and he's willing to do it. Now, the shape of the tomb isn't the only unique thing. It's not. Also, the paintings on the wall are unlike anything the other pharaohs are going to have. What they've got are stick figures drawn all along the walls. Now, pharaohs always had religious texts on their walls. You know, when you look at those beautiful art books and you see paintings of daily life scenes on people's walls that I've been talking about, they're not the Valley of the Kings. Those are the tombs of private people. Pharaohs had only religious texts on their walls. And that's what Thutmose III has. He has religious texts. And what these religious texts look like, it's papyrus roll. They're stick figures. They're as if they're drawn. They're not completely beautifully done gods and goddesses. No, no. It's not super beautiful. It's interesting. Right? What I think he's done is, in a sense, had his Book of the Dead, this guidebook to the next world, drawn on his tomb walls. The first one ever to do anything like this. It's quite something. It's painted even to look like a papyrus. Some of the background sometimes looks papyrus-like. So it's really quite a unique tomb. And that's where the greatest military leader of Egypt was buried. And it's open to tourists. People can go there and see it. But now that the workmen have finished the painting, now that they finished carving inside the tomb, what do they do for the last thing when the pharaoh is buried in the tomb? They carve away the steps that let them get into the tomb. So when you go to see it now, you know, or if in ancient Egypt, even better, in ancient Egypt, right after Thutmose's death, after he's put in the tomb, they carve away the steps that's the access to this high opening in the cliff. And then you're just walking on the ground. You don't even see it. You don't even see it. So access was almost impossible to this tomb, almost impossible during ancient times. Today, when tourists go to see it, there's a long step the big stairway that's made out of metal that you can go see it. But the thing to do when you go to see it is look at the walls as you go up of the cliff. You can see the workmen's graffiti where they were practicing, trying to do the figures. You'll see a ram-headed god that they tried to draw. They're just practicing on the wall until they got into the tomb. But it's in this very special tomb, very special, that Thutmose III, the greatest pharaoh that ever led an army, by far was buried. But next time, we'll talk about what happens after him. Egypt keeps rolling on. See you next time.